Today is Tuesday, March 4th, 2008. This is Susan Resnick. I am in the lovely home of Dr. James Cabo, which truly is like an oasis in the middle of La Jolla. I have come to conduct his oral history interview for a project associated with San Diego State University Special Collections. It's supported by the Adams Humanity Grant. Dr. Cabo served San Diego State University with distinction since he arrived in 1973. He is a chemist, a professor, a Guggenheim Fellow, and he served as graduate dean and vice president of the San Diego State University Foundation since 1975. He was appointed vice president for research and dean of the graduate division in 1997. Good morning, Dr. Cabo.
Good morning.
Tell me about your early years. I'd like to know when you were born, where you were born.
Oh, we're really going to go way back, are we?
Well,
I was born March 15th, 1926, back in the Midwest, in what was then a little city called Kansas City, Missouri. It sat on the Kansas-Missouri border. We were a poor family. My father and mother had come from a little town in Kansas, 100 miles to the south. And took their savings and went to Kansas City to start a new life. My father didn't want to continue on the farm where he was born. And got there just at the time the Depression hit. And so he didn't have any particular skill, but he was very good at auto, what we'd call auto mechanics nowadays. And he went in with a car dealer, and he handled the used car part of the dealing. Well, after the recession was and depression in those days hit, we felt, even in the Midwest, no one was buying used cars and nobody was buying new cars, so the place went out of business. Mm-hmm. And the man that owned the place went out to San Diego. And after he shortly got out here, he wrote a letter to my father and said, come out here to San Diego. I think there is some money to be made. But he didn't want to move his family out then. Mm-hmm. So my mother and I stayed in Kansas City and lived in a little tenement apartment on the fourth floor. And my father was in San Diego. So I was really raised from the time I can remember going to school, which is about 4 or 5 years old, until I came out to San Diego when I was about 13. And back there, had lots of relatives around. And while we were poor, we weren't as poor as some people. Mm-hmm. And so my mother was very clever at letting me ever think that we were poor. We were just, she said, lower middle class. Mm-hmm. In those days, people had talked in terms of classes.
Right.
So I had a very interesting life there. My mother encouraged me to read. We had little neighborhood schools I went to, and I remember doing a lot of writing, directing a school play. I started as a little school newspaper. I was interested in electronics and electrical things, and so I built kind of a home lab in my bedroom. Came close to electrocuting myself a few times. They wouldn't allow anyone to do what I did then. And then got interested in chemistry and particularly interaction of the various chemicals and solutions and electricity.
Was that in high school?
No, I was not. That was all in grade school.
Really?
Sure, grade school. And I'm a little mixed up on the grading system because it all keeps changing. You know, when I was a student, we had grade school, mm-hmm. and then junior high school,
right.
and then high school. And so I think that the grade schools went through sixth grade back there, and then we had 2 years of junior high.
Yes.
And so I went to junior high. But because of peculiarities in when my birthday was, and because in small schools then, the teachers kind of moved you around, I somehow skipped two grades. And I don't, my memory of that has to do with where we lived at the time, because during the Depression years, after my dad lost his business, we went out to live with my uncle in kind of a semi-resort area out over the borderline between Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri. And it was a suburb of Kansas City, Kansas, and it was called Overland Park. It's now a big, huge development. And so we lived out there for a while. And that was a country school, and they didn't have kindergarten. And so I never did kindergarten, and I was young, and they started me in first grade when I was five. Mm-hmm. And then when I got back into the city again, to Kansas City, they decided that I ought to be in something grade, and mm-hmm. I essentially skipped me another grade. So I was always 2 years ahead of my age, which some people think, oh, isn't that wonderful? No, well, it really wasn't, because I was younger than my contemporaries. And I always felt at some disadvantage being younger. Fortunately, I grew up fast so I could hold my own against the bullies. But nevertheless, I just didn't feel the right age. And so I was never thought it was a good idea to advance children. The idea that they get bored and so forth, I just didn't understand. You know, that just means that parents have to spend more time seeing that they don't get bored with their intellectual development. But that's kind of old-fashioned thinking, and it wouldn't probably work nowadays, I'm sure. So anyway, there wasn't much discuss about Kansas City. I've been back there. I took my son. We went back there and visited my cousin, who took over from his uncle, who was his father, who was my uncle, mm-hmm. my mother's brother. He took over that property, and he went on to become manager, the publisher for the Kansas City Star. And I visited him and my son did, back in Kansas City, where he retired and lives now in a beautiful suburb of Kansas City. And the reason I mention all this is because those few close relatives I had back in Kansas City were very important to me. Mm-hmm. And my mother worked day and night, and I was on my alone a lot. And so I just learned to kind of stand on my own 2 feet, you know, and developed hobbies and did reading. I had a bicycle. I went out by myself, and my mother trusted me. She thought I was fully responsible, and I can't ever remember getting into any difficulties. I think the bike skidded a few times and I skinned my knees, you know, mm-hmm. But I never broke any bones. So I have mixed feelings about Kansas City. It was a place where I was on my own a lot and mm-hmm. could develop all my hobbies and could develop friends of my own. But on the other hand, I didn't have the normal family life that many children have and enjoy, and I kind of miss that.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me the names of your parents?
Yes, my mother's name was Crystal.
Ah, pretty.
Crystal Cobble. And my father's name was Ray Cobble. And they're both dead now. They lived into their 90s here in San Diego. That's part of the story
right.
coming up. But they were divorced when we came out to California. And my father remarried. So I had a mother and a stepmother in the same city. That was a little awkward, too.
How old were you when you came back to California?
When I first came to California, I'm not sure, but it was either I was 12 turning 13 or I was already 13.
Okay.
And we lived in a duplex, a two-story duplex on 9th Avenue, very close to Ash. And if you remember your topography of San Diego, it's across 163 to San Diego High School. And so I had taken a year of junior high in Kansas City. When I came out here, they decided I should go right into as a freshman in high school. And so, by the way, a half a block from where that duplex that we lived in is where my daughter now has a townhouse, and she and her husband and my two grandsons live there, just a half a block away. Now, the whole area has changed.
Right.
But I found out the address by going down to the library, looking in the phone book, and there under my mother's name gave the address. At the time, they used to put addresses in the phone book, you know, as
That's
well,
right.
the phone number.
Right. So did you find a big difference after being in the Midwest, coming to California, as far as the kids were concerned or the type of school?
Well, I thought it was going to be kind of fun to have a dad again, because I had missed one, you know, 13. I hadn't yet had a father, although I had an uncle and an older cousin, my mother's first cousin back there, and their family. And so he was just like, they were my substitute fathers.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when we came out, I thought I was going to have a father again, and I had to leave all of my electronic and chemical stuff at home. Everything we had, we put in the car and moved out. So anyway, I got a job, had a bicycle. I could walk across 163. It was not very crowded, and they had a pedestrian walkway. You could walk right across to San Diego High. I could hear the bell sound for classes and rush out the door and be there in 3 minutes flat. Now, you see, when I got out here, it was in 1939. And San Diego High School, to me, was just a wonderful place. It was what they called the old gray castle in those days. It was made out of stone and looked like a castle. I went into the orchestra because one of the things I took up was music when I was back in San Diego. I took up piano lessons, and my piano teacher was the church organist, and so she gave me some organ lessons too.
And then they had a
person that would move around among the grade schools, and I learned of how to play the violin. Because I didn't own a violin, but they furnished the violin in the schools. And so I had lessons with three or four other young people there in the children in the grade school, and learned to play the violin halfway decently. So when I came to San Diego, San Diego High was well known for its orchestra. And so I interviewed, and the director of the orchestra, a very famous man in those days, known as Nino Marcelli. And older people in San Diego recognize his name. He started the first San Diego, I don't think he called it symphony, he called it San Diego's Orchestra. And the only auditorium we had in town at that day was the Russ Auditorium on the San Diego High School campus. And so I got in the orchestra. And he told me, I don't need any more violinists, and you don't play that well anyway, he said, but I do need viola. And so he got me a viola, and I learned to play the viola, which is much easier to play than the violin, and it rarely has any solos. And so I was happy then. They had a very fine chemistry lab, and the chemistry course was wonderful, and the sciences were very strong at San Diego High. And I had a job in a bookstore down on Broadway, and I had my bicycle, and I earned some money, and I worked part-time in the library at the high school, and I was having a ball.
Terrific.
And I met my wife-to-be in the orchestra.
Oh, how nice.
Her name was Margaret Ann, and she played the flute. Now, she had had private lessons. She had played the piano, too, and she had had private lessons the flute. So she was a very good in playing the flute. But that's what I met her. And so first thing I knew, we were going together and dating and went places together. And isn't that amazing that I met my wife-to-be?
That's wonderful.
When I was 13 years old.
That's wonderful.
And I blame it all on music.
That's lovely.
So, everything was going fine. The last year I was a graduate started out in 1941, and then, of course, in the year I was in 42. And you know what happened December 41?
I certainly do.
Pearl Harbor came along, and we were all not scared, but wondering what it was going to mean, because rumors were flying around that the Japanese were going to invade Mexico and march up into San Diego. We'd be the first one they would take over. We had this big naval port, and the submarines were first going to bombard us. And so I had grown up suddenly pretty well. By that time, I was 15 years old. And that was my senior year.
You were young for a senior, that's right.
Still young, but fortunately I had grown up. And they asked me if I would volunteer to be an air raid warden, because I had the height for it, and I seemed like a nice guy, would follow instructions. And so the first thing I knew, I was an air raid warden. That was in January, February, I guess. It happened all pretty fast. And San Diego didn't know much. We, down around on Pacific Boulevard, they put up some netting and put camouflage over the top, so that the aircraft industry down there was camouflaged. And they made everyone drive at night. If you drove at night, you had to have the headlights in the car had to be run on dim. And you had to keep your blinds closed at night. I can't remember all the details. So I had my gas mask and my whistle and my billy club. I don't know what the billy club was for. And so they would have drills. And when they'd have drills, I would walk up and down about a half a mile each direction from where we lived. And if I see lights, I'd knock on the door and tell them to turn the lights out. They would always smile, you know, and I never had any trouble. Mm-hmm. But I was scared to death.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember that on part of the walk I took, I passed by some... Now, this was getting to be in the springtime. You know how all the flowers come out and bloom? Mm-hmm. And I had never walked by a huge patch of jasmine. And it smelled just beautiful. But it smelled just exactly like one of the war gases that we had been told to smell. And we had this little kit, and you would open them up and sniff, and it'd tell you which war gas. And I was determined that someone had set off a war gas going to poison the whole neighborhood. So I went off, I ran home and told my mother, and she said, "Well, let me come with you." And she said, "That's just jasmine."
Oh, that's funny.
I felt so stupid.
That's funny.
So the war survived without me. And that summer, I graduated. I just turned 16 in March.
Yeah.
And then graduated from San Diego High. And back in Missouri, we had no intentions that I ever go to college. There was no college in Kansas City, and I couldn't by any chances afford to go away. And so I was interested in electronics. My mother thought I could be an apprentice to working in the radio repair shops. Or when I was interested in chemistry, she thought I could be an apprentice pharmacist and get to be a pharmacist, because in those days you could be a lawyer and a pharmacist by being an apprentice and then passing the examinations.
Right.
So that was what I was set out to be, a pharmacist. Well, in high school, they talked to you and said, "What are you interested in, chemistry?" She said, "Well, you can go get your degree at San Jose State College." I said, "I don't think I'm going to college." And they said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, we don't have the money." She said, "It's free at San Diego State." Well, it wasn't exactly free. Well, but $30 or $40 a semester. I went home and told my mother. I said, "I can go to college." And she said, "Well, I'm sorry, Jim, but I don't know what they've been telling you. We can't afford it." And I said, It's only $30 a semester. And we were both overjoyed. And so I said, I better get started with the war coming along. So I started summer school that first summer when I just turned 16. I went out to state and started taking some courses and working part-time. And that's how I started San Diego State.
Oh, that is
wonderful.
And
that was in 1942, I'd started San Diego State.
Okay, so let me just put it on again.
So after I went to a summer school at San Diego State, I started out with a bang in the fall. I took 18 units and had an advisor who was wonderful, and I had tested out what we in those days called dumbbell English, much to the chagrin of my wife, who didn't pay much attention to those college entrance exams, and she had to take dumbbell English. And she was the one that was so literate and so interested in literature, and every once in a while I want to dig at her, and I said, well, okay, well, I never had dumbbell English, so I don't know about things like that. And I took chemistry, and I absolutely fell in love with it. I just knew at that moment that my interest in chemistry was extremely high.
Was there a particular...
I took biology the first year of there, and I knew right off that I could never be a doctor or a physiologist. I could not stand to dissect frogs and all those things. And my wife used to make fun. I couldn't even draw a decent picture of a bird. You couldn't tell the difference between my birds and cats. So I knew I had, one, no artistic abilities, and two, I was not interested in biology. But we got to chemistry and physics. That turned me on, and I really was interested, in spite of the fact that my chemistry teacher had his bachelor's degree in Latin. He was a Latin teacher, and they didn't need a Latin teacher, and his minor had been science, and so he got a good textbook, and he just stayed ahead of us, and he was wonderful. He was really wonderful because he expected us to know what was in the textbook, and he had a good textbook, and if we asked him a question of something he didn't know the answer to it, he'd say, I'll let you know tomorrow, and he would go look it up. Wellstead was his name. I'll never forget his name, Mr. Wellstead.
Okay.
And I already told you about the orchestra conductor's name, Marcelli.
Yes.
Nino Marcelli.
Yes.
And then two other things that happened to me. There was a woman by the name of Perkins. I forget her first name, in high school, and she taught a course in public speaking. And I took that course, and it was probably the most important course I ever had as a student anyplace. It taught me to speak. It taught me to think. It taught me to think on my feet. It taught me not to be afraid when I get to a class or before a group of people. And I look upon that course very highly. That's probably considered too pedestrian of a course to teach nowadays, but it's everyone ought to have a course in public speaking, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The second most important course I took back in Kansas City in what was called junior high school, and that was a course in typing. And boy, now I can whiz around on the keyboards, and my computer experts say, where did you learn to do that? And I said, oh, more years ago than I care to recount. It's like 60 years ago or 65 years ago, and they all smile at me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like by a bicycle. Once you learn to type, you'll never forget it. You may go out of practice, but you never forget it. So anyway, I reinforced my interest in chemistry. What was happening at the time was that all the faculty were disappearing. We had two wonderful chemistry professors at San Diego State then. One was named Dudley Robinson, and three, actually. One was, I don't know what his first name was Mesmer, M-E-S-S-M-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the third chemistry professor will come back to me.
Okay.
In talking, I can't think of it right now.
That's okay.
But the two, Robinson and the other man, went off to work for the Navy laboratory here in town.
Oh, that's what happened, yeah.
And a lot of the faculty were leaving. None of them were drafted, but some of them enlisted. They felt that, you know, they had a real job to do. But Mesmer was very good, and so he taught me general chemistry, and I took general chemistry, analytical chemistry, and biochemistry, and organic chemistry in 2 years. I just crammed every course I get my hand on. There were only really two faculty members, and there was a young man from USC who about the year or two after I left died of a heart attack. So he obviously wasn't in the war for good reasons. But anyway, I got to do experiments of my own. They had little laboratories, private, small private laboratories off some professors' offices, and Mr. Mesmer said, go in there and do any experiment you want. So I had a ball in chemistry. And then they made me, in my sophomore year, a student assistant for the general chemistry lab, which gave me a key to the stock room. And if you're interested in chemistry, the point I used to be when I get your fingers on bottles, to go through a chemistry stock room and see all the names of bottles and chemicals that you could only have heard of, and there they were, it was a real turn-on. Every chemistry student should be allowed or forced to go through a chemistry stock room and look at all of the chemicals and their names and these things that were only formulas you knew how to write down a piece of paper, and there was potassium chlorate. There it is right there. And here's cesium iodide. I never really knew what cesium iodide was.
That's exciting.
And here was perchloric acid. I knew there was such thing. There was a bottle of it, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a very interesting experience. Even as I grew up, again, I was kind of on my own. So anyway, I took literature, I took history, I took chemistry, 18 units a semester.
Oh, a lot.
And then during the spring, after my birthday, I think I was in, by that time, 17. I knew as soon as I turned 18, I'm going to be drafted.
Oh.
And I didn't have much interest in being in the Army. And it was a Navy town. I was kind of interested in the Navy. So we heard by word of mouth, because there was on the college campus recruiters, to go in what was called the Navy V-12 program. The Navy V-12 program was where you could, you'd sign up, they would let you go to college for so many years, then they would send you as a midshipman to a midshipman school and then commission you and put you in the war.
Oh.
Those were called the 90-day wonders, because midshipman school was 90 days long.
Okay.
So I can remember, of course I was too young, and my mother had to sign the paper, and she was kind of horrified, but she did it. She knew. I said, I just got to do something. I just can't sit around and go to school. Everybody else, I'll find the war. And so that's what I did. And my girlfriend had left. After the first year, Margaret Ann got a scholarship to Berkeley.
Oh, wow.
I told you she was a smart one in the family. And
so
she went to Berkeley and graduated from there. And I didn't see her for a long time after that. But anyway, so I signed up in the Navy V-12 program. I had to get a special waiver because of my age. I should have been a year older, but they gave me the waiver, and they were fairly desperate in those days, you know, to get their hands on people. And so they allowed me to finish that spring semester, which is the second year, and in the summer, and then I got my orders in the summer to report to the V-12 program at what was then Arizona State University at Flagstaff, now Northern Arizona University.
Right, right.
Lovely little mountain town,
right,
sitting up in at the base of the San Francisco Peaks, where the Lowell Observatory is where Pluto was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
As Harvard's observatory. And it was a small, like San Diego State, a teacher's college. It was turned into a college.
Right.
And now turned into a university. So they sent me to Flagstaff. And I spent three semesters at Flagstaff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard work. Because we had to take some military courses, and we had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and do calisthenics and run around the circle there, the old quad, with the snow on the ground, you know. We had to keep the dormitory rooms were taken over. The students gone. There would have been a V-12 program at San Diego State, but they had no dormitories.
Oh.
But Flagstaff had dormitories, and so they took over the dormitories. And I visited there not long ago when I took my daughter and her family to a resort area in Arizona.
Sedona?
Sedona.
Yeah.
And we took a drive up to Flagstaff, and I could sign some of the old buildings, and some of the buildings were named after some faculty. They were now dead, but I had names I remember. So anyway, and after a year there, which includes three semesters, I got orders to go to Notre Dame, the Flagstaff.
All right, let me turn it on again.
And after I finished a year at Flagstaff, I got orders to go to Midshipman School at Notre Dame in northern Indiana, at South Bend, actually, is a town.
Mm-hmm.
And so off to Notre Dame I go. That was for 3 months. That was the most intense, worrisome experience in my whole life.
Really?
And the reason for it, by that time, we had invested so much time and effort in, in learning Navy discipline and everything like that, and how to behave as an officer. We were going to be an officer. But people would keep disappearing. They would disappear because their grades would be too low, and they would get sent in the Navy. Well, they had no Navy experience, so they were sent to what we call boot camp in those days,
mm-hmm.
which you could go directly into and not have to go through all this business.
Mm-hmm.
I was very grateful to V-12 because I got to get to quite a bit. By this time, I'd accumulated more than 3 years of college.
Oh.
So off to Notre Dame. And it was very thrilling to think, I was going to finally get into the war and be an officer and
mm-hmm.
and have a bed to sleep in at night instead of having to sleep in a foxhole.
Mm.
By the way, and just going back just a little bit, when I was at Flagstaff, there was a physics professor there who was also an organist. And so we used to go down and play the organ in one of the churches there. And so I got very interested in playing the pipe organ again. And we got to Notre Dame. There wasn't much time to do anything, but we would have some on Sunday, a weekend, and so after church on a Sunday, I would go down and play the pipe organ at the Baptist Church in South Bend. It was an old, old organ, but it was a lot of fun, and
mm-hmm.
it took my mind off of things for a little while. And my platoon, we were organized in platoons mm-hmm. at Notre Dame for marching purposes, had 30 in it. And we would wake up in the morning and all of a sudden somebody would be missing at muster. And what they would do is come in and tap them on the shoulder in the middle of the night, pack their gear, and ship them out to boot camp. So they were gone the next morning. And these people kept disappearing. And so out of the 30 that started my platoon, only 20 finished. And so we were kept in terror all the time.
Oh.
Every exam, if you failed one exam, you could be pushed out.
It's hard.
So we never knew what was going to happen. If you got too many demerits, you were gone.
Mm.
Anything, and they said, well, that's the way life is. It's too bad.
Mm.
I actually think the problem was that they had found out they had let too many people in the V-12 program, and they had to start getting rid of some of them before they commissioned them. So finally got my commission, and I thought, well, it's off to war. And they said, well, not quite yet. We want to send you to advanced line officer school. By the way, the Notre Dame campus is a beautiful campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my first touch of Indiana. I had never known much about it. It was up on the Great Lakes, and we used to go. There was a fair-sized, I don't know, it was a patrol boat, I guess, and we would go out and go up and down Lake Michigan shooting shells out into the lake for gunnery practice. So they sent me to Advanced Line Officer School, which was essentially a Merchant Marine Academy that had been taken over by the Navy by the Navy in Fort Schuyler, New York.
Oh.
Set on the peninsula, a little between Long Island Sound and the Hudson River, I guess it is. And a little peninsula out there was the Fort Schuyler. And we were already commissioned, so they were teaching us various things. Actually, it turned out it was a waiting place because they didn't know where they should get give us specialties that would be useful in the war in Europe, or specialties that were going to be useful in the war in the East. And so I think it was a waiting place. And they just wanted us to sit around, so they would do there. And the ships were, of course, by this time, the Navy was huge. You know, ships coming out, you know, I forget how many ships they were turning out every week. And so the logistics of it were pretty terrific. So after we'd been there a few weeks, they asked what we would like to do, what our specialty would like to be. And one of the specialties was underwater activities, such as demolition and submarines underwater. I didn't want a submarine. I just don't want to be cooped up with that many people. I've been cooped up with people in dormitories that long. I wasn't that guy. underwater demolition seemed pretty good. They're going to send you to Florida and teach you to tank work and all that, and to stay underwater for hours. I thought, now that sounds really daring, you know, for a young man. Instead, I finally, when I was at Fort Schuyler, and finally said, well, your term is going to be at a close. In a week, we're going to send you to Hawaii. Yeah. But you got a week essentially to fool around. And it turned out I was in downtown Manhattan the day that peace was declared on VE Day.
Oh.
You know, with millions of people down in Times Square.
Those famous photos.
I've seen pictures of it in history books. I was one of those little heads around there.
Oh, my.
I've never seen a city go wild. It just was beyond anything that I ever could imagine. And people were feeling so wonderful and so happy, you know. And to think that the war in Europe was over. They didn't realize what a job was ahead of everybody for the war in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So after saying goodbye to New York, I went to operas there. I went to symphonies. I went to restaurants. I got a taste of New York, which has never quite gone away. My wife and I visited there a number of times, and I have been there once or twice since. So I headed to San Francisco, tried to get down to San Diego, but didn't have a chance. Caught a plane to Hawaii, Honolulu, and was put up in some officers' temporary quarters there, which was pretty nice, actually. And every day, all I had to do was check in to see if I had transportation to find my ship. And I knew now my ship I was going to go on was the USS Delta. And it was a big, it was not very exciting. It wasn't a warship, but then I didn't have any skills as a warrior, I guess. It was a huge ship that had everything on it that could repair the sides of destroyers and battleships. It had drop hammers and forges in the way down in the bowels of the ship. It had electronic shops. It had torpedo repair, radar repair. It had everything. It was a technical ship to repair fleet ships. So all I had to do up in Honolulu was to show up once a morning to see if I had transportation. Huh. And I'd show up, and after a week, I said, I don't think they're ever going to get me out of here. And so by this time, I made friends with some of the people, and there was a guy, and I said, how long have you been there? And he said, oh, I think 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, have you been wedding for 6 weeks? Have you got a transportation? He said, I don't know. I only go about once a week. And I said, well, are they going to check up on you? And I said, do they look like they're checking up on anybody? So I want to get out of Hawaii. I mean, it was a lovely place, although it was not the kind of Hawaii that people know of now. It was on a war alert, of course, mm-hmm, and the bay was just awful with the debris of all the bombings and everything. So, eventually caught another ship that was to take me to meet my ship in some islands in the South Pacific. Hmm. One of ones which was called Mog Mog. I have no idea where it was, and I haven't bothered to look it up. It was in the South Pacific where my ship was. I got to Mog Mog, and I said, oh yeah, your ship is over in Okinawa. Because that time the Marines had stormed Okinawa, and I was in the process of cleaning it up, and so your ship is in the bay at Okinawa. So I traveled over to Okinawa. I got there just in time before the big hurricane had hit, and my ship, like other ships, were sent out to sea to escape the hurricane. But here I was stuck. And so they gave me a tent and a kit that could purify the water and some food, and said I'd head to the hills and find myself a place to stay for the night because mm-hmm. it's going to rain pretty hard. And so there was another guy like me trying to find his ship, and so we went up there and we did everything right. We dug a trench so the water would run around the thing, and we got under some trees and put our tent and hoped for the best. And it rained. And I've never been in a hurricane before, but I've been in that one. And so when the heavy rains hit, which is after the eye passes over, and I've learned since, uh-huh. a torrent. We unfortunately picked out a kind of a semi-valley, which hadn't flooded for years and years, but it started to flood, and the water came starting up. So we had to grab our tent and head for the hills. We had a flashlight, and we saw kind of an opening in the rocks back there, and we went back in there, and it was dry. And when morning came, the sun came out, and the air was just looked beautiful and everything. It was a burial cave that we had gotten ourselves into.
Oh, my. Oh.
So we went back down to the base, and it was a mess. The LSTs and the landing craft that couldn't do anything on their own, the small boats that couldn't have gotten away from the hurricane, were all over the beach. There was food and whatever, and the ships were coming back in. They were trying to clear the harbor. We volunteered to help clear the debris up, and then spent most time wandering around Okinawa, eating sugarcane. It's a beautiful island. Mm-hmm. So finally, I got transportation. That they thought was going to pick me up to take my ship up. They weren't exactly sure where it was. And then what happened? Japan sued for peace. That the atomic bombs had dropped, you know, on Nagasaki and right. Hiroshima. And they'd sued for peace. And my ship was to go, like most of the navies, to Tokyo Bay. And so they said, we can't get you to Tokyo Bay, but there's a ship going to the southern part of whatever the island that Tokyo was on, Honshu or something like that, I can't remember the name. Mm-hmm. And there I was to catch a train up to Tokyo. And then from Tokyo I was to go down to the Port Harbor officer and try to get a boat to my ship, which was anchored in Tokyo Bay. Mm-hmm. And that all took place. I rode a fast Japanese train back into Tokyo, which the windows had all been broken out. And this was now, I forget when peace was declared, in the fall of the year, but it's kind of cold. I don't even remember the year. Do
1945?
You? 1945. And so I found my ship. I got on my ship, the AR Delta. What do you know? I finally found it. And it was anchored in Tokyo Bay. It was anchored right next to the Missouri.
Oh.
Where the peace was going to be signed.
Oh, my.
So we had our binoculars, and we were going to be able to watch the peace being signed on the dam. We were a good-sized ship. So I gave my assignments. I had a very nice cabin with two bunks, wide, nice mattresses, and I had the Laura, and my roommate, who was another 90-day wonder, had the one on top, and a porthole, and, you know, it was luxury compared to what most people had to put up with. So I was assigned Officer of the Day duties, and it turned out during the ceremonies, I was Officer of the Day, which meant I was in charge of the whole ship, under the captain and the commander. And so I can't now think, may I use the wrong term, maybe it was Officer of the Deck. I think it was Officer of the Deck rather than Officer of the Day.
Okay.
I'm confused. So we were all on one side of the ship looking at the Missouri, and we couldn't see well enough to see who the dignitaries are, but you could see MacArthur. He was a very towering person standing up there, you know. And you could see the Japanese dignitaries. And it seemed to me we were getting closer and closer. And finally the captain turned to me and said, "Mr. Cobble, I think we're drifting into the Missouri. What are you going to do about it?"
Oh, my.
I looked, and we had not knowing anything about the tides, the people tied the ship up to one buoy, but not on the bow, but on the stern. And so I panicked, went down, got the chief. They put on the boat, they put the line, they put in the buoy, they pulled themselves in. Otherwise, I'd have probably ended the rest of my day in Portsmouth, which was a naval prison, and had an infamous name among all officers. If anything terrible was going to happen to you, they're going to send you to Portsmouth Naval Prison.
Oh, my.
So that was my biggest saving thing I did during the war, was to keep us from drifting into the Missouri and causing an international incident.
Well, that's a wonderful story.
The captain admired me for my thinking fast. The commander, who had been an old Navy man, thought I was so stupid I should spend the rest of my life in the brig for not checking that in the first place as soon as I became Officer Deck. Well, anyway, I can't tell you much about the naval experience. It was pretty dull. We were anchored actually in Tokyo Bay, but it was off the another major city at the entrance of the bay called Yokosuka. And it's like the difference between, I don't know, it's like, I'm trying to think it to be the comparison, but it would be like, you know, the difference being at Point Loma and down at National City.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to learn a lot about Tokyo.
Huh.
And they put shore patrol out in all the villages in Japan for fear that there would be underground terrorists, whatever, plotting and things like that. And so within a 100-mile radius of Tokyo, I would get in a jeep once a week and go out with my overcoat on and my revolver strapped to my side and my official-looking hat and stand out in the center. There's various one villages after the other, and watching the Japanese go by as they did their business, and particularly in the snow time, their shoes were in terrible shape. Their little buses ran on charcoal. The people looked cold and hungry, and they smiled and nodded to me as they went by. And there I stood along with this town statue, whatever it was, out in the center of this little town.
Mm.
So we did that for about 9 months.
Oh,
and
right.
Then, of course, the war was over, and they started to say, "We're going to send you home."
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story short, they sent me home. And in the meantime, my high school girlfriend...
I was just going to say, where was Margaret Ann?
Well, there was something in the newspaper that said, James Cobble is stationed in the occupation forces of Japan, and he can be contacted. And I gave my Navy PO address, and she wrote me a letter. Uh-huh. And so I wrote her back. And we started getting back in correspondence with each other again. And
had she graduated from Berkeley?
Not yet. She didn't rush through college. And she had to work in the summer, so she only took the regular load for a year. And she had been deficient in some courses for Berkeley that she didn't get in high school, because she hadn't planned to go to Berkeley in high school. She had planned to go to San Diego State. And so, anyway, I got shipped home. I remember in San Francisco, and mustered out in San Francisco and came back to San Diego, and all my family were happy to see me again.
Sure.
And so much for my naval experience. But to my surprise, they gave me credit for the all my service time, including the time they'd sent me to college. And so I used the GI Bill to go to graduate school, and I went to USC.
Uh-huh.
And when I was in graduate school, I used to commute on the wonderful trains we had going back and forth between USC and San Diego, and begin to date Margaret Ann as well as you can long distance that way. And we got married.
Aha. Uh-huh. When did you get married?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. But it was in 1945.
Okay.
And
where did you get married?
In Margaret Ann's home here in San Diego.
Okay.
She lived over on Pershing Drive. And on University, it's on Pershing, it's just off of University, three or four blocks off University, as you're heading into North Park.
Mm-hmm.